Hello and welcome to the Reaction Podcast. This is Alistair Bem, Deputy Editor. I'm joined by Maggie Pagano, our Executive Editor, and Ian Martin, Editor of Reaction. If you like what you hear, please do subscribe on our website, which you can find at www.reaction.life, and you can read all our content there, and you'll get a daily briefing from the team and a newsletter from Ian as part of that as well. So this week we're going to talk about peerages and knighthoods and the palavers over that, and a little bit on the SNP's troubles, and maybe a little bit on the incredibly exciting contest for the Metro Mayor of the West Midlands, which is going to take place later on this year.
And maybe a bit on Spiral.
And on Spiral.
Spiral. Or Spiral.
It's
Spiral. Just Spiral.
Spiral. You mean engrenage?
Yeah.
Precisely.
You? And you know, if you gearing. The direct translation, it's not Spiral, it's gears.
Exactly. Gear or no, gearing.
Yeah. But then...
Oh, no, well, okay, but my French
literally.
Is
Spiral,
gears.
Or Spiral, as we call it in our house. Why does everyone call it Spiral?
Is they're trying to be French?
Is it just...
They think they're being
think
French.
A
Spiral.
But it sounds like a... Well, I don't know. I actually called it engrenage with everyone.
There,
yeah,
yes.
Exactly. So I wouldn't know. I remember I came across it because my dad, who is a French speaker, calls it Spiral. So there is no pretension there. It's just...
But he's translated the English Spiral to exactly. How you would say it in French.
Yes. Yes. So at the end, we're going to discuss Spiral.
Can we also...
Can we start with Spiral? Because I think we're all obsessed by it. It's
right,
all your fault. I blame you. Can I just quickly say, over the last 3 years, about five or six people have said, Maggie, have you watched it? No. Missed it entirely. Then when you wrote it last week, I think it was last week, wasn't it? About one in the ten. That's it. We are now, it's that midnight thing. Do you think we could just do one more? So we're series three, and it's incredible.
It becomes so addictive that you, and I don't like box sets, but you're right. I had chosen it as one of my top 10 reasons for thinking Europe's great, even though Britain has left the European Union, which is not the same as...
We are part of Europe.
Which is not the same as Europe. And... I don't like box sets, but it is strangely addictive, and the production values are so high, it just makes a lot of British-made stuff look really mundane and clichéd. The team are really cool.
Yeah, they get some properly good guest stars as well. Like, each series has a genuinely quite famous...
Really?
Do they?
I just thought they were like French actors.
Well, in the second series, the guest star is... No, in the third series... No, sorry, in the fourth series, the guest star is in...
No spoilers.
I think the film A Prophet, in a leading role, and he's absolutely incredible.
Right.
And he plays what? It's A Prophet.
He, in the fourth series...
Fourth, you jumped ahead. Okay, yeah.
So I didn't...
But anyway, Spiral's brilliant.
But he's also very dashing, isn't he? Gregory Fitoussi.
Oh, him, Pierre Clément.
Goodness me.
Yes. Yeah. But it's brilliant. It's interesting, because the economics of short storytelling in print are now dire, so... No genuine serious novelists really do short stories, or it's quite rare to see a genuine, you know, because just no one really reads it. But the form of the short story is dominant in TV storytelling, and something like Spiral uses it really well, because it's like these like Maupassant style, you know, episodes which just have everything. They have almost everything in it,
everything,
and
they're
also very clear, and it's brilliant.
And what I really like is that they never go back to what happened in the previous. So, you know, Laura has her affair with the head of
no,
drugs.
What? No, spoiler!
Oh, okay.
Spoiler.
Sorry,
we'll
with
edit that bit
okay,
out.
With the drugs guy, but he doesn't reappear in the next series, so she's just left. So you've got all these lovely little compartments, if you like, of stories. No,
it's
very clever.
I should stress, for any French listeners, I didn't wish to imply that there is no such thing as a guest star or celebrity who's French. Of course there are famous French actors, but I just meant I didn't realise that they had that they were guest stars. Yeah. I didn't recognise them from
But if we're going to talk a little bit about culture, the thing that's been absolutely bugging me is that Uncut Gems hasn't got any recognition at the Academy Awards.
Right.
That is an amazing... For any listeners who haven't seen Uncut Gems, it's on Netflix, it's in cinemas still, I think. It stars Adam Sandler as this Diamond District, this diamond dealer in New York, who is obsessed with gambling on huge sums of money, gambling about his life. He's actually, and it's directed by the Safdie brothers, who directed Good Time, which stars Robert Pattinson, is also a brilliant film. And it is just like this most incredible heart attack of a film, with also incredibly nuanced take on modern American Jewishness, because Sander plays this almost like what you might call a Shylock trope of a Jewish guy. He's sort of seamy and horrible and all the rest, but it kind of knowingly goes inside all these tropes about Jews. Like he has a wife who sort of hates him, and then a girlfriend who adores him, which again is a kind of medieval trope. And it's not just that, it's the whole, you know, it's just everything about it is brilliant. And it hasn't got any recognition because maybe the Safdie brothers are quite new on the block. And probably because people think Adam Sandler is, his goofball comedies are, they're not respectable enough. But that it's just, anyway, I'm rambling about it, but go and watch it.
So
it's
after perfect. Spiral, then
so, yeah.
we'll take that up. Yeah.
Advice, want to go to the cinema on Sunday, 1917 or David Copperfield? Only go do one show.
Should
I go for?
David Copperfield is his, sort of, you know, is good, yeah, sort of fun.
Okay.
But 1917, I don't know, something about it. I can't really be bothered.
No, I feel, again, another gory.
If you want to see a really anxious film about, like, where, you know, you're constantly on edge and all the rest, go and see Uncut Gems, because that's way, you know, that's a landmark film in cinema. Anyway.
Right.
So we didn't start talking about Spiral there, but what was the other... what was the main topic we were going to get stuck into?
We were going to say whether Boris Johnson was right to include Philip Hammond along with Ken Clark in his honours recommendations, which we believe they're coming out next week. And you can imagine a lot of Eurosceptics who do not think that Mr. Hammond probably did more than anyone else in the Treasury to try and destroy the...
Yeah. I can see the argument in... I think it's a mistake to include Hammond. I think Boris was always going to give a knight, not a knighthood, peerage to Ken Clark.
Absolutely.
Because Ken Clark is someone who's, despite everything that happened in the last couple of years, is popular among the Tory tribe, or significant parts of it, popular out in the country, was a highly successful Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Probably one of the most successful.
Yeah, pretty good record. Up to 1997, and he's also, for a prime minister like Boris, who thinks of himself as, he puts it, thinks of himself as Brexity Hezer, as in he has the lot in common with Michael Heseltine in terms of style and substance, also on infrastructure and all the rest of it, grand project. He was always going to give it to Ken, but I just think Hammond is a different case, and I think that the way in which he behaved after the 2017 election ended up causing a difficult situation to be made even worse. Now, why did he do that? He was treated appallingly by May in the first phase of the May government. From 2016 to 2017, he was constantly briefed against by the Mayites as being for the sack.
Yeah.
And then it was briefed that he would be for the sack after the election because May, having appointed him, found she didn't really click with him, and her team didn't really rate or like Hammond. But then, having been made himself unsackable simply because of the election result, he then just set about being, he would, I'm sure, present it in different terms, but I, from my perspective, as obstructive as possible. And particularly on something like the city, a situation I followed very closely at the time, the Treasury under his leadership was pretty much just prepared to fold on the question of the city being regulated by the EU. And it's one of the crucial insights, fascinating to see the FT now post-Brexit come around to this position in its leader this morning. There is no way that an institution or collection of institutions as large as the City of London and on a global scale can sign up to being regulated by email or by fax in the old days from Brussels, Frankfurt, or anywhere else in the European Union. And Hammond led the charge on that, and much else, and was wrong. And then I don't think he should be forgiven. But Boris is clearly in a forgiving, bring the country back together mood.
Maggie, you're not a fan of Philip Hammond.
No, I thought he was duplicitous. And nothing wrong with taking the view that Brexit would be damaging. You know, that was a fair point of view, and you can argue both sides. We don't know. No one will ever know the answer to that one. But I thought that he behaved very badly behind the scenes, and particularly, Ian, as you were saying about the city, and basically he would have given in on the city's demands entirely, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
He was quite prepared for them to be rule takers forever.
And the reason, that a lot of Eurosceptics in the Tory parliamentary party or Brexiteers view him with suspicion is not just that he did, as you described, Maggie. He also, they can remember that Philip Hammond 10 years ago was more Eurosceptic than a lot of Brexiteers. He was, when I first encountered him and heard him speak, he was as Brexity as you could get without actually declaring leave the European Union.
Even when he was Defence Minister, he was still, you know, giving Eurosceptic speeches. It was most extraordinary. Whether it was going native in the Treasury that sort of got to him, or I don't quite know what explains, but it was complete volte-face.
Yeah.
Complete.
And then the rest of the list, as you say, Maggie, probably get it next week, I think before the recess on Thursday, and can expect to see people like Dan Hannan, Boris's big fan of, who was an MEP. You can expect him to go to the Lords, and a whole swathe of other interesting people. But
a few city people like Michael Spencer.
Yes,
I think
but
get a peerage.
Possibly. Yeah, everyone is being very.
What about Nigel
Farage? About it. I assume that you can't get anyone really to answer any questions about this, because of course by the appointment committee there, and they're all being vetted.
Mm-hmm. But you,
they're told to say nothing.
Ian, in the past, you sort of supported a peerage for Nigel Farage on the basis that that's what he really wants, and you give it to him. Then he's.
I know. To the extent that someone changed my Wikipedia entry to say Ian Martin supports Nigel Farage getting a peerage. I can't remember if last week on the podcast I did mention that Nigel Farage called me a complete cunt. I can't remember.
No, you didn't.
It was great. It's one of the proudest moments of my journalistic career. We had a really, really good, amusing conversation as Brexit was looming.
Yeah.
And I think we agreed to have lunch or dinner or something. And he said he shouldn't, because of all the terrible things I've written about him in the war of the last few years. Anyway, so I will go and have lunch with him and see what he's up to once he is Lord Farage. Well, maybe he isn't. I just think it when I go and look at the House of Lords, and there are many good people in it, I just think it just, after everything that's happened in British politics in the last 10 years, if you can't have Nigel Farage and maybe one or two other prominent people
from
Hammond.
That
strand. Yeah, and you have Philip Hammond, but you don't have Nigel Farage in the Lords.
No,
I think you're taking the piss out of the voters, really.
What I thought was so bizarre, actually, and really short-term, was that they didn't immediately after the referendum. That's when they should have asked him to into the House of Lords, because actually they would have diluted a lot of his... bring the enemy inside rather than pissing on the
possibly,
outside.
Possibly, though, I don't think he wanted to do that. I mean, there are various conflicting reports. He has said that he has been offered a peerage at various points and said no. I don't know if he's been offered this time. There's no word of it. No word of it yet. But then this is the first podcast we're recording since Brexit, actually.
No. We've done one.
No.
Oh, since Brexit.
Since
Saturday, Friday night. Yes,
it's quite bizarre,
right.
Actually, the way in which the world has moved on. I know that the country is in transition.
Yeah, the sun shines a little brighter.
Yeah.
The lambs are skipping. Well, not quite, maybe. But
how did you feel about it on Friday night, Alistair?
I felt absolutely nothing.
It's like New Year's Eve, actually, isn't it?
Does that mean you felt sort of existential emptiness, or you,
yeah, as
you
usual.
Didn't really bother?
It was curious. I walked through Westminster at about 7 in the evening because I was meeting someone in Soho, and there, you know, the pubs were packed. And there were people sort of prancing around with English and Union Jacks flags, and just thought, like, but I always find those protests in Westminster just a bit silly.
Yeah, they are.
And
they're much of a muchness,
really. I mean, I just remember the walking past Stephen Bray and the Euro Brexit man, who's still there, actually.
Is he?
The Stop Brexit man.
Oh, right.
He's moved on to Why Brexit. He once shouted it into my ear, and I turned around and told him to F off. So, there we go. Yeah, so, but, and he... Sorry, this is totally uninteresting, really.
No,
but
it is. Very interesting.
It says something about the craziness of last year. Is he had set up, basically, on a pavement, which is quite busy, by College Green, with all of his troops.
Mm.
And I'm no wilting violet, you know, I'm quite a big guy, but I always felt one of these people can step out and literally push me into the road, because you're all gathered on this quite slim pavement.
And then it goes into the barricade, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So you're slightly pushed.
And I always felt this is a...
Vulnerable.
This is an indulgence, and actually also potentially, you know, a health hazard. So
not only did he fail to stop Brexit, he was a health and safety nightmare.
But how did everyone feel? You know, I just... You know,
I felt really elated, I have to say. I didn't expect to, after the weariness and depressing antics of last year. I really quite enjoyed it in a way that I didn't expect to, and I had feared that after all that Brexit wouldn't be allowed to happen. So it did feel to me like a great democratic moment. I'm not starry-eyed about the future. I don't feel that there's some amazing boom just coming for the sake of it.
Although things do seem to be improving. On the economic front, we've had some really good news this week. Manufacturing index right up, the services up by 5 points, exports up. So actually, it sort of looks as though a little bit of a...
I hope so. I mean, the stuff that's happening in China worries me in terms of... Now, in one sense, you could say a Brexiteer would find it... A hard-line Brexiteer would find it amusing that... Mm. The hit to that's taking place with the German economy, you see their 19th month in a row that I think some factory output is down, and so that is explained by the slowdown in China hits an export driven economy like Germany. So you could say, well, look, Germany's struggling, France is, and it's only one quarter still to be revised, but France is flatlining. So Britain's going to be fine and confidence is rebuilding, but I can't quite see how, if the Eurozone flatlines, it doesn't have some sort of impact
on the UK,
plus the trade dislocation we're about to go through.
Exactly, and half our exports are still going to the European Union, come what may, so we don't want low growth there. It's in no one's interest.
But this is negative talk in the great Boris Bozza, you know, feel the enthusiasm, there's a boom coming stuff, which I hope he's right about. It is interesting, though, that when I mentioned it there, we hadn't, in our preliminary discussion when we were working out which subjects to talk about, I don't think we mentioned it. Just had happened on Friday, and the world has moved on or factored it in.
Yeah. I must say, the thing that has amused me this week is that the campaign ads, or whatever it is, it's an ad from the Conservatives, which a lot of people are celebrating, which features a man in a flat cap meeting Boris Johnson, and it's a surprise. He's being interviewed about. He's a first-time Tory voter, and
he's the Grimsby man.
He's interviewed, and he says, "I'm Labour to my core. My family was, and now I've voted Tory for the first time." And then sort of Boris like comes on from off stage and surprises him, and a lot of people saying this is a genius ad, and Boris sort of carries it off by being quite amicable. But while watching it, I was just like, the country squire meets the dependent.
Well, are you too young to remember Ted and Ralph from the Fast Show?
No, well, that's exactly it, isn't it? Ted and Ralph.
Which is Phil. I can't take credit for that. It's Phil Collins, who just retweeted the Boris video with the words Ted and Ralph.
I haven't seen
it. For those who aren't familiar with Ted and Ralph, that's the squire who's in love with his sort of gamekeeper, estate manager, who has to spend all of his time sort of
drainage in the lower field.
All of that.
I don't know.
You know, there's a genuine
part of life
genuine feature film which is like an hour and 45 minutes long, just about Ted and Ralph YouTube.
Oh
yeah, it's and it features Ted's being sort of bewitched by this aristocratic woman who's actually out there to like grift all his possessions and money, and then Ralph, and then Ted kind of saves him, I think.
Yeah.
I remember watching it.
So
there's great danger, isn't there, that they are creating a sort of false parody out of this, you know, the sort of, as you say, the sort of, you know, intellectual middle class. And the, yeah, which is very never, I mean, what Boris didn't do in the run-up to the election, he didn't patronise the public. He went and spoke to him on his own terms. This now feels like, oh, well, we got our Grimsby man, and we got the Red Wall people, and we're going to keep, you know, we've got to, you know, and he did the very humble thing, we merely borrowed these votes, which was very generous, blah, blah. But if they sort of go on about, they've now just got to say we're working for the whole country. It's all about, what it showed us is that most people are aspiring, despite of their class. If you try and now break this down into class things, I think it weakens it.
Well, also, as someone pointed out on Twitter, it wasn't really even a proper flat cap.
No.
It's one of those sort of, it's one of those hipster flat caps.
Yeah. Which I'm not sure they wear flat caps in the Red Wall. Anyway.
No, but they have hipster flat caps in the North now as well.
Okay.
So,
well,
but there is a real danger for the Tories.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. I suppose the phrase we use quite a bit on this podcast is show not tell.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just don't think people are not idiots, and they're going to. Voters in the North have clocked all of this, quite sceptical and cynical about politicians, and will judge on what actually happens rather than bits of...
Which is their pocket.
That's
and if
true.
They don't do, and there's a weakness so far, what we haven't seen is the Tory party look at how they will help the man in the street and the entrepreneurs, the startups. So we haven't seen any... sort of talk about how we are going to help the small business community, which is where all the growth will come from.
Yeah.
We've had the big heavy spending, NHS, police, all this stuff, but what are you going to do to help the guy in the Red Wall or Grimsby when he wants to borrow some money to get a fishing boat? Hopefully he might start again. You know, that's the missing link. And the big question is whether the Chancellor is the right man to do it or whether he has those instincts.
I think he is. I think... Of course, the week's been dominated in Westminster terms by reports of rows between Dominic Cummings, Chief of Staff, who sort of thinks he runs the whole of the government, and the Chancellor, who's a Minister of the Crown and a Privy Councillor and is clearly quite determined to be
Put
the Chancellor rather than be bossed about by the number 10 Chief of Staff, which is it's an old new version of an old row, which usually never ends well for the political party that has conflict between number 10 and number
11,
although it can sustain for quite a long time. I thought the most interesting piece on all of this stuff was actually in the Wall Street Journal. It was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, which I think we mentioned in our five things on the Daily Email for subscribers, which was one of the first pieces I've seen which got right into the productivity thing, which that's the main problem with the UK economy, isn't it? It's managed to produce an employment boom, but it's still with productivity lagging, you then don't really feel the proper effects in terms of the gains which give you dramatic increases
in
wages.
Yeah.
And better, and
but you have full employment, but the trade-off is that you have stagnant wages.
Precisely, yeah.
But, you know, but in France they have higher productivity,
yes,
but they spend more on capital-intensive goods and higher unemployment. So it depends your trade-off.
But the journal's analysis was, and there was a bunch of stuff on machinery and equipment and capital investment and how it's sort of written down or written off against tax.
Mm.
A bunch of measures which hadn't seen really anyone on this side of the Atlantic write about. Their argument being, you look at some of the reforms that the Trump administration has done. So Trump administration growth is lower than Trump keeps boasting about,
but it's
consistently the US economy is performing better than
better than Europe, and it is doing it on the back of quite a lot of deregulation and stuff, which is aimed at increasing business investment.
Yeah.
I just thought it was an interesting counterpoint. So if you get to the budget beyond all the stuff which people want, you know, bits and pieces of money for this and that, that, I think it will, whether the budget works or not makes a real difference, and whether Sajid Javid survives and prospers or not, it'll, the real test of it will lie in the stuff related to productivity and business investment, which the Bank of England seems to have just completely given up on this. But maybe they're just saying, right, it's over to the Chancellor, let's see what the Chancellor produces.
Andy Haldane's still working on productivity. But just quickly, but the trouble is that the only story one has seen to emerge from the Treasury on what they might do in terms of tax reform has been to abolish entrepreneurs' relief, which would be insane. I mean, it only raises 2.4 billion a year, but it's the entrepreneurs that you want to encourage to then set up the next business. So if that's the tone that's coming out, I tell you, there's a real fight back going on in the city at the moment, just saying that this is insane.
Okay.
So it should be the reverse. It should be saying we want more reliefs, and all R&D incentives should be increased.
Yes,
very well. So we'll keep campaigning for that.
Just quickly before we finish up, the S&P have had a terrible day.
James
Mackay.
Gosh,
illustrating
he's
that
been
this
and gone very
global
quickly.
Political superstar,
who's Andrew Mackay,
whose name you can't remember, Derek Mackay.
I was on the tip of my tongue. Derek Mackay, who's the finance minister, obviously has had to resign over having sent inappropriate
text.
Messages to a 16-year-old boy over quite an extended period.
270 of them.
What is it about the SNP? I mean, and the SNP has its roots in, I mean, we talked about this before, the SNP and its in early, I mean, this is a different kind of, you know, this is fundamentally, this is a different era, but the used to be very blokey.
Yes.
When it was in its infancy.
Yeah.
And that, you know, is connected to some, you know, they've had serious sleaze problems in the past.
Yeah, it was always I'd better say this carefully, funny wee cult. It says in my notes, cult. And
the party.
Yeah, for a long time. Small group of people all working very closely together. It's only had three leaders in the last 30 years. I should say that at some point you've got to head off on a story, haven't you, Maggie?
Indeed.
But we're going to carry on talking.
Okay, I'll leave you to it.
On
Scottish experts.
Maggie's off to go and find a real story, and we'll stay here talking about the resignation of
the cult experts.
So is that a, what's
just on a fact on a moment, somebody tweeted, and it was rather brilliant, saying if it had been Sajid Javid or Gordon Brown or Philip Hammond texting 270 messages to a 16-year-old, you know, the whole government would have imploded. So how can Sturgeon survive?
No, it is a massive.
I'll leave it to you on that note.
It is a massive story, and the SNP. You know, it could not have come at a worse time for the SNP, because, as you say, there's a budget, and they're just about to face the trial of Alex Salmond, which we can't talk about because it's happening in the High Court in Edinburgh starting on March the 9th. But that makes it a really embarrassing moment for the SNP. I didn't answer your question, Alistair, about why it is that the Scottish politics seems kind of prone to this. I mean, there is a particular... English politics has loads of scandal as well. I'm not saying Scottish politics is particularly... Scottish politics has scandals and England doesn't. That's clearly not the case. But there is a particular character to Scottish political scandals. I'm reminded with this SNP thing of what happened when Scottish Labour were at their peak and they were hit by a whole wave of sleaze and resignations of first ministers. And it's something to do with it being a village, I suppose, and the parties are run by small groups of people who live sort of cheek by jowl and drink together and socialise together and play politics together.
So it's nothing to do with the national character.
Well, I think we've talked about that before, haven't
we? Holy Willy's prayer, you know, back to the original self, you know, the hypocrites, corruption. You know, yeah. He's the great figure of someone who is a bit of a Scottish stereotype, someone who is actually very immoral but presents this face of purity and believes in these abstract notions of predestination, saved, and all the rest.
I mean, I did think when I was writing about Fred Goodwin years ago, would I go down that route of saying that there's something particularly Scottish and Presbyterian about this, and is there a thread, you know, through the Darien scheme and the wild over optimism and our attitude to football and the fact that we're probably overconfident about Scots, about England versus Scotland at Murrayfield on Saturday, where the Scots are due an absolute kicking. So I concluded that really that this, there isn't really, you know, the English had the South Sea bubble, the English have moments of overexcitement and drama, so do the French, so do the Americans. There is, you're right though, there is something culturally that there, it's there in Burns, isn't it? And it's there in the really austere humorlessness of Calvinism and Knox and sanctimony. And so sometimes when I see Nicola Sturgeon shouting about Tories, 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 and there's definitely a connection there.
Yeah, well, things like James Hogg, Confessions of a, was it private? I never remember the title. The Private Memoirs and a Confessions of a Justified Sinner.
Yes,
which is a sort of James Hogg. Weirdly, we had a portrait of James Hogg up in our dining room at home when I was growing up.
Wow.
With the subtitle The Ettrick Shepherd. And I, growing up, didn't know who James Hogg was, and I assumed he was a Borders poet.
Yeah.
Which, weird, you know, and he's clothed in this plaid costume. And even, and this was, interestingly, his own self-construction. He was a shepherd from the Borders, but when he came to Edinburgh, and this was in the early 19th century, and hobnobbed with new Enlightenment elites, people like Walter Scott, he had this literary persona called the Ettrick Shepherd, which was this humble rural type. And then he wrote this insane novel, which is, as far as I can see, it's about Calvinism, and it's a satire of Calvinism, and it's got this, the confessions are this guy's confessions, who is a Calvinist, who becomes possessed with the devil, and it's the template for a lot of novels about doppelgangers and dualism, and including Robert Louis Stevenson. But it's also an interesting take on, as he saw, I think, Enlightenment rationality, where people were encouraging this notion that the civic space was one in which free and rational individuals could meet and cooperate. And the way they meet and cooperate was through coming to know more about each other. So you get to know about other cultures or whatever. And he says, no, that's not what happens. What happens is the more you know about something, the more you're intimate with something, the more you feel revulsion and hatred for it. And he brings in a kind of whole psychological element, which is taken up by people like Freud and Nietzsche, which, you know, kind of takes apart sort of progressive optimism about politics, which is something we've had real dire reckoning with in the last decade, is people realizing that just being cosmopolitan, blandly cosmopolitan, normally ends up creating huge antagonisms in politics and in the course of politics, and ends up destroying the kinds of values you actually want. But in Scotland, that is there's that tension between high idealism and, you know, a kind of weirder, more grotesque Gothic.
But there's a curiosity in Scotland, isn't there? Because the SNP are simultaneously, they are a manifestation of just what you've described with cosmopolitanism, European values, that they, in their own eyes, embody the progressive spirit. But they're also the populists.
Yeah.
They're also the populists who want to smash up the system and break up the union and employ the rhetoric of the nation.
Yeah.
I can't decide at the moment whether they are existentially stuffed by Brexit or not. It's too early to say. The polling at the moment is, there was a couple of polls of the last few days showing that they're support for independence is at around 51-52%, and some nationalists were cock-a-hoop about this, but I that's not really where I think they should have been after the events of the last 18 months. They should have, because Scotland is being, as they keep saying, taken out of the European Union against its will. So this is the peak Brexit moment, unless there is some complete economic catastrophe, and they're still polling at roughly half and half.
Yeah.
Or is it that I'm, as nationalist friends tell me, I'm just refusing to see what's coming demographically, and that just there are younger Scots who, below the age of 30, they've just decided that England or Westminster is alien, and that they'll take the economic pain, much in the way that Brexit voters said, well, you know, we'll take a hit on the economics because we care about the sovereignty and identity thing.
Well, I don't know. I share that. I don't know what to think about it. At one point, I think that maybe in the short term, I think for the kind of chattering classes in Scotland, it has become more palatable to vote nationalist than maybe it was 5 years ago. Mm. But then, you know, it comes back to the old question. I know I've got relatives who are really pissed off about Brexit, who are in Scotland, really annoyed, and think that it's been a complete shambles, and they've wanted to reverse it ever since it happened. But when it came down to it with the election last year, at no point did I ever feel that anyone I knew was going to vote SNP. And it would, in the polling booth, you'd always come round to, you know, either the Tories or the Lib Dems or something, or not basically a unionist party or Labour. But it's, so I think there's an overinterpretation of the cultural shift, without recognising that the union, which is what nationalist thinkers often do, underplay the genuine reality of union and the genuine vigour of what Fintan O'Toole wrote in The Guardian is an amalgam of nations. In a slight, is that, do read it, it's quite a good piece by Fintan O'Toole for him. I find him pretty crass normally. And
is this a different piece from the one where this week he said that Sinn Féin had to be part of a progressive government in Dublin?
It is a different piece, and it's quite good. But we've spoken about him before. But it's like he's read a bit of Freud and then thinks that's just how nations work. So he goes on about Britain with this, England with this complex around, you know, ownership and control and domination. It's just.
No,
when you see it, it's just like, okay, you know, there we are.
I debated with him and found him very charming at the FT Weekend Festival, me on stage with Alistair Campbell in a room of 800 Remainers, but that's all part of last year's kind of fever dream. But of course, the irony with the Fintan O'Toole thing is that for several years he's been lecturing the Brits on saying that essentially just English nationalists, and now it seems that if the election works out as it might do in Ireland next weekend, then Sinn Féin might have to play some sort of role in government. I mean, it's bizarre considering that it is a party which is backed by what's ultimately a sort of paramilitary army.
It's a pretty dark history there. But coming back to Scotland, I mean, I think that two things need to happen. I think the cultural shifts are there in the sense that union is not the, we're having to debate it the whole time. It's not just the reality in which we all live anymore as it was for in its high periods in the past. Yeah. Union was just, that's just the dominant mode of politics.
Yeah.
And obviously in the last 10 to 20 years there, it's opened up into two things, nationalism or unionism, and we've been trying to accommodate it through devolution, trying to understand what it is, and to some credit, there's lots of great nationalist thinkers who are trying to work out what this new Scottish aspiration is, whatever it is. It might be a cultural thing, it might just be about greater political recognition or whatever, but I think the union, you know, nationalism and nationalists have had it have had it fairly easy in recent times, and they've been able to concentrate Brexit into, you know, a bellwether moment in that in that debate, and it's really concentrated their minds. But I think the long-term gains of that will shimmer away into thin air, because what did the SNP actually gain out of this election, which will set the tone of politics for 5 or 10 years in the UK, which was in 2019? What did it gain? It gained a few extra seats in Westminster, which does that matter? But they managed to create in bidding for that election at a time when Labour were absolute shambles, and Boris had a very potent offer to the English electorate. They managed to create a majority government that has the ballast to take Britain out of the European Union, which makes it makes the practical argument about independence basically impossible, in terms of, you know, especially Boris's deal on Northern Ireland. The new arrangement that Northern Ireland will have, because of Northern Ireland's special status and the historical sensitivities around the border, that deal effectively means Scotland cannot exist outside England within the European Union without border posts.
Yeah.
Because we now have an effective customs border in the Irish Sea.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an unfashionable view for a long time, but it's Brexit does potentially make Scottish independence more difficult, because for the reasons you mentioned, plus the question about currency, about whether you're going to use the pound, or I think the policy now is to have a new currency and then maybe have to join the euro. Of course, you have to join the euro to get back into the they have to join to get back into the to the European Union. But the block they have now, and the thing that I detect talking to people in Scotland, is that it's starting to dawn on the smarter SNP thinkers and strategists that Boris's approach, if he sticks to it, means he's probably not going to get a referendum for 10 years, because his position, which I think there's a health warning attached to, I think it's really difficult to say there shall not be a Scottish referendum if the Nationalists get a majority of the seats and a majority of the and a plurality in the popular vote next year in the Scottish elections for Holyrood, then it seems to be that he's determined he's just going to carry on saying no. I do think that will morally become difficult, but if he sticks to that, and then if he does win again in 2024, then the Nationalists find themselves 10 years out of the European Union with, well, we'll see what's happened to the economy, with a very difficult sell to get back in. The question then is whether unionists have attempted to remake the union in some way, or to rebuild the case, or introduce constitutional reforms. We've talked about federalism on here before, or further devolution, or cross-border projects of some sort. But it is, for all the hype, it is quite difficult for the SNP.
Yeah, and it's, well, speaking as someone who, after the Brexit vote happened, I immediately thought of the union as under threat, because we'd had the referendum in 2014, and I just felt a huge wave of relief after that. Someone, you know, my dad's English and my mum's Scottish, and, you know, grew up with a family down the UK, lots of emotional reasons, all the rest. But I think there is an element of over pessimism among unionists about Brexit, and you see it a lot. Is really intelligent commentators, for some justified reasons, say, you know, it just changes the cultural weather, but that's only true, I think, if you see the European Union as part of a broader positive story about pooling resources, goods and capital going across borders, creating new solidarities, which as a unionist, that's what I encourage, you know, is part of the great story of Scotland's partnership with England, was this notion that as you expand and as things progressively increase, you kind of the, you know, it's, the, it's sort of bounceless over time, and that's good. But that's in the other direction. If you're like a Marxist and you think in terms in, of core and periphery, where it's unions always be interpreted as England sort of just dominating the periphery.
Yes.
Which is, and that analysis is given edge in the last 30 years after deindustrialization. That doesn't really function either, I think, because of the genuine vitality of the Scottish economy, and that it was actually, by the end of the 80s, it was relatively much better off than much of England. But it's more of a story, and I think the union just, it has to, as you said, it just has to find a new way of telling that story, and whether that's through constitutional reform or economic growth or whatever, it has to change to survive. But
I think a lot is going to be decided by what happens to the Scottish Labour Party. I know that sounds counterintuitive. So there will be people listening, if they're Scottish nationalists or even if they're unionists, who laugh and say, well, sorry, the Scottish Labour Party's dead, finished, and it is doing very, very badly in the polls. Why do I think it matters? It matters because the original argument for devolution and the structure of the proportional voting system was all predicated by Labour devolutionists on the basis that there would always be a unionist bloc of the Labour Party remaining strong, Scottish Tory Party reviving, and the Liberals retaining their geographical concentrated presence, and that those three together would always shut out the nationalists from majority government. Obviously that didn't work because the Scottish Labour Party decided to commit suicide, and it is in beyond serious trouble. However, the one thing, and there have been false dawns for the Scottish Labour Party before, but we live in an age of extreme volatility and novelty in politics. If you get a situation in which, say, you get Keir Starmer as leader, or Lisa Nandy, I think would be better, but say it's Keir Starmer, and he can persuade Richard Leonard, I think of them as the two sides of the same coin, to stand aside as Scottish Labour leader, and for them to get someone a bit more effective, it wouldn't take that much. It would take the Labour Party in Scotland putting on 7 or 8 points in the polls and just taking enough off the SNP vote to create a real competition. And if that happens, the nationalists are set back and have quite a difficult 10 years in which they have to rethink their argument for leaving the oldest single market in the world, which is the UK.
But I mentioned briefly the Metro Mayors, and that's what Labour need to do. And Liam Byrne will be a competent competitor to Andy Street. And it's the same in Scotland, they just need more competent talent and to keep it there.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think we've pretty much got through.
Yeah, I have to say, apologies to our listeners. As soon as Maggie left, we ended up talking about Scotland for about 20 minutes, so which was hopefully interesting. The union certainly matters, but if it was too much Scotland, we'll promise it'll be less Scotland next week. Can I just ask you, if you're not a Reaction subscriber, go to the site and you can subscribe for £5 a month, £52 for the year, though the price is just about to go up, so be quick. And if you subscribe, www.reaction.life, you get my weekly newsletter on politics, you get brilliant evening email briefing from Alistair and the team every evening, and you get full access to the site and all of the great journalism produced by the Reaction team. But until next week, thank you very much for listening.